Welcome.
You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program, and this one is being recorded for the listening week that begins March 9th, reading from a variety of sources. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. Opening with articles from the DenverUrbanSpectrum.com. First, on a one-woman play titled Pioneering Paths, the story of Hattie McDaniel, a living portrayal by Vicolin Reynolds. Article was written by Latrice Owens, published February 29th. Historic entertainer Hattie McDaniel paved the way for generations of Black performers, from humble beginnings in Kansas to her historic Oscar win for her role in the classic film Gone with the Wind. McDaniel's journey embodies iconic talent and resilience against all odds. Alongside McDaniel's entertainment legacy, actress and singer Vicolin Reynolds has emerged as a modern-day torchbearer, channeling the trailblazer spirit through her own theatrical pursuits. Reynolds' acclaimed one-woman show, Hattie, What I Need You to Know, reflects her dedication to preserving McDaniel's legacy. Both women symbolize the power of representation and the enduring impact of those who dare to follow their passions. Shared Beginnings and Inspirations. Born June 10, 1893, in Wichita, Kansas, McDaniel was the youngest of 13 children. Her mother, a gospel singer by the name of Susan Hulbert, and her father, a member of the 122nd U.S. Colored Troops, were both formerly enslaved. When McDaniel was 7 years old, the family moved from Kansas to Colorado, eventually settling in the capital city of Denver. McDaniel discovered freedom of expression through reciting poetry and captivating audiences at East High School. She left school early to focus on her budding career, which carried her from Colorado to the West Coast. Initially, she showcased her songwriting talents alongside her family in the McDaniel Sisters Company Minstrel Show, which performed at carnival shows represented by one of her brothers. Her show featured female-focused storylines and perspectives, leading to the creation of her famously outspoken Mammy character. She also launched a radio singing career and performed with Professor George Morrison's Melody Hounds in Ensemble, which was on tour. She was able to dance while singing the blues, earning the nickname the Old Pep Machine for her cheerful nature. Throughout the 1920s, she continued to refine her craft, traveling with Black vaudeville groups as a blues singer and becoming the first Black soloist on Denver's KOA radio station in 1925. Raised in Philadelphia, Reynolds' childhood was immersed in creativity reminiscent of McDaniel's Colorado upbringing. Her childhood performances, often staged in her mother's bustling beauty shop, mirrored McDaniel's youthful penchant for entertaining classmates with her musical talents. Reynolds attended Overbrook High School, performing arts school, where she was able to hone her talents. Later in life, she received the Drama Logue Award for her role in The Colored Museum. She also faced a pivotal decision after high school. Despite plans to attend nursing school, she received an offer to join a singing group called The New Day, encouraged by her brother, Tony Award winner Ron Richardson, who believed her talent shouldn't be wasted. Reynolds also sought her mother's advice, who said, "You have to do what makes you happy. Just be the best at whatever you are," she remembers her mother saying. Inspired by her family's support, Reynolds chose to pursue her passion for music. She was signed by Philly International Records while still in high school and lent her background vocals to renowned artists like the Spinners, the OJs, and Michael Jackson. Reynolds learned about the first Black Academy Award winner at an early age and chose to honor McDaniel by incorporating her own experiences and creativity into her work, writing 10 of the 12 songs featured in Hattie, What I Need You to Know. In addition to sharing a striking resemblance to McDaniel, Reynolds' research found parallels between their lives, further fueling her desire to bring her story to life. She began writing the play in 1997, dedicating a decade to its development. Debuting in 2007, the show captivated audiences in Denver, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Over the years, awards received include the LA Ovation Award, the Vivian Robinson Audelco Award, and the Black Theater Alliance Award. She was also nominated for the Drama Desk Award for the Colored Museum at the acclaimed New York Public Theater. Through their respective contributions to the entertainment industry, both McDaniel and Reynolds left indelible marks on music and performance, embodying creativity and artistic innovation. Touching Hollywood, McDaniel's path to Hollywood stardom was marked by her ability to overcome obstacles. Despite setbacks, she seized an opportunity to work as a restroom attendant at Sam Pick's Club. She sang and hummed as she worked, leading patrons to demand that she be included in performances. She continued to pursue Hollywood aspirations with hopes of showcasing her acting skills. Simultaneously, McDaniel left her mark on radio with the optimistic Do-Nuts. Pardon me, that's probably Do-Nuts. That would be spelled D-O-Nuts. Making history as the first black person to star in a weekly radio program on The Beulah Show. This achievement further shattered racial barriers in entertainment. Reflecting on a poignant moment after a performance of Hattie, What I Need You to Know, Reynolds recalls how her rendition of the original song, A Childless Mother, deeply resonated with an audience member, providing a cathartic release and leaving a lasting impact. This emotional connection exemplifies McDaniel's ability to transcend boundaries and touch hearts through her shared stories. McDaniel starred in approximately 300 films throughout her career, though she received credit for fewer than 100 of them. No other actor is known to have such an extensive filmography. Having lived during a time of overt racism and bigotry, she faced numerous challenges in her career, including typecasting and criticism from organizations like the NAACP, which accused her of perpetuating stereotypes. In defense of the roles she accepted, she pointed out the realities of employment opportunities for black people during that time. She said, "Surely you don't think the roles I portray are obsolete?" McDaniel once pragmatically challenged and said, "I can be a maid for $7 a week, or I can play a maid for $700 a week." Despite these obstacles, quote, "she was so loved by Hollywood, both black and white," says Reynolds. McDaniel was actively involved in advocating for change within the industry. She worked with the Fair Play Committee to enact changes in scripts, such as removing racial slurs. Her role as a pioneering black actress continues to inspire discussions about representation and equality in Hollywood. Reflecting on the importance of McDaniel's story, Reynolds believes that her stage play is an important contribution that honors her legacy and keeps her spirit alive. Reynolds says, "I would love to see it become a movie." Honoring McDaniel's spirit. Before her brother passed away, he urged Reynolds to delve into McDaniel's story, suggesting that she explore the entertainer's life despite negative connotations surrounding her roles. Actor Larry Riley agreed, encouraging Reynolds to take on the task and advising, quote, "if no one approaches you with the idea, write it yourself." Riley's words, spoken on the set of the film Polly, resonated deeply with Reynolds. Following Richardson's and Riley's passing within a year of each other, she felt compelled to honor them by taking their advice. Reflecting on their guidance, she recalls, "I thought, oh my gosh, maybe these guys are leaving me something. I think I was actually born to portray Hattie McDaniel." She goes on, "Her story is inspirational and not just for show business. She beat all odds." Reynolds is an honorary member in the Sigma chapter of Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority, Incorporated, echoing McDaniel's affiliation with the same sorority. Inspired by her philanthropic legacy, Reynolds contributes to initiatives supporting marginalized women, including those recently released from prison, by providing clothing and resources for job interviews. She is working to establish a foundation honoring McDaniel, aimed at empowering young women transitioning out of foster care by teaching essential life skills. Through her endeavors, she ensures that McDaniel's spirit of compassion lives on. McDaniel passed away in 1952 after battling breast cancer and surviving a heart attack. Her death occurred during the filming of the televised version of The Beulah Show. She was posthumously celebrated with dual stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, one commemorating her contributions to radio and the other to film. In 1975, she was inducted into the Black Filmmakers Hall of Fame, further solidifying her enduring impact in the entertainment industry. In 2010, she was inducted into the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame. Reynolds, who is widely recognized for her role in the 1995 comedy film Friday, continues to advance her own career as a celebrated and respected figure in music, television, film, and theater. While continuing to forge her own path, she is working to preserve the legacy of her predecessor and one of America's greatest change-making pioneers. Next article, still in honor of Women's History Month. Another local magazine, 5280, brings us Aspen's Mawa McQueen is in fuego, and she's only getting started. This was written by Katie Coakley, and it was published February 22nd. The proprietor of Aspen's only Black-owned restaurants, Mawa McQueen, is returning to her roots while continuing to grow her empire. Chef Mawa McQueen is proud of the fact that she's made her home and her career in Aspen. But if you think that working in the elevated resort setting for more than 20 years, opening three restaurants, earning a semi-finalist nomination for the 2022 James Beard Award for Best Chef, Mountain, and writing a cookbook might slow her down, think again. This force of nature has plenty of plans for the future. Here, three of McQueen's newest ventures. Mawita in Snowmass Village. Mawita, McQueen's newest restaurant, opened in December 2022, promising Latin-inspired cuisine, but don't ask her if it's a Mexican restaurant. McQueen explains, quote, "Mawita actually came about because now more than ever, I'm trying to embrace my roots, and that's African. And so far, everything I've done doesn't have anything to do, truly, with who I was. So I decided to do something that was me." End quote. McQueen opened Mawa's Kitchen in 2012 in the Aspen Business Center after running a successful catering company for 6 years. Prior, she worked front of house at White Barn Inn in Maine and the Little Nell in Aspen. It was at Mawa's Kitchen that she says she realized that there are a lot of similarities between African culture. McQueen was born in the Côte d'Ivoire and moved to Paris when she was young, and Mexican culture. She says, "It's the same ingredient prepared differently. Take yucca. We pound the yucca, fry the yucca. They don't pound the yucca. They fry it. They boil it." She goes on, "Plantain. They think they created plantain. Honey, it was us. This is the funniest thing." While there are many ingredients shared between the two cultures, it's the preparation and the seasoning that differ. McQueen says, quote, "Many people come to my restaurant and say, oh, you guys started a Mexican place. I'm like, dude, no, this is African. How come nobody noticed that we had so much in common? The result is a menu that delivers exactly what McQueen promises, Latin cuisine with an African flair. There are three different guacamoles, three different salsas, two moles, and a variety of tapas and other dishes. Chapulines a la Mexicana, parentheses, patacones topped with crispy grasshoppers, jerk chicken tacos, and mole rojo are standouts. More quintessentially McQueen twists include the fondue de queso, an elevated version of the traditional cheese dip, the truffled yucca, or the boogie tostado, topped with 30 grams of royal Ocetra caviar, scrambled egg, and patacones. The decor also reflects the marriage of Latin American and African cultures with bold colors and design, including a hanging garden, a dual-sided fireplace, and wallpaper that McQueen designed herself. Mawita serves brunch, lunch, apres, and dinner, so there are plenty of opportunities to sample every option. The cookbook Mawa's Way. In the midst of opening a new restaurant, McQueen also released a cookbook, Mawa's Way, last December, and though it's her first, it will not be her last. Based on her early catering days in Aspen and her menu at Mawa's Kitchen, the book is full of clean, simple, good food. But it's also highly personal, a glimpse into Mawa's journey from her childhood in Côte d'Ivoire to moving to Paris and taking care of her 19 siblings, to her journey to the United States, first in Vermont, where she met her husband and business partner, Daniel, then to Aspen. The recipes are accessible, eschewing the niche tools, ingredients, and techniques that some tomes embrace. McQueen explains, quote, I don't like foo-foo, fancy food. I want real food with flavor, so that's what I did. With more than 100 recipes, including fan favorites from Mawa's Kitchen, like chicken yassa and her highly requested gluten-free carrot cake, the cookbook is packed with culinary knowledge. It's available for purchase online or at McQueen's restaurants for $28. A dinner series in Aspen and Snowmass. Yes, the James Beard nod is a highlight on any chef's resume, but perhaps the best prize is the opportunity to network with other chefs. After attending the James Beard Foundation's Chef Action Summit in Houston this past January, McQueen returned to Colorado with the fire in her eye. She's excited to collaborate to bring different flavors and diversity to the rarefied air of Snowmass. On February 23rd and 24th, she hosted a pop-up dinner with guest chef Opie Amosu from Houston, the first in a series of guest chef events that she's planning for this year. Amosu, who owns Chop and Block in Houston and appeared on an episode of Top Chef Houston, will celebrate Black History Month with a four-course menu of Nigerian-inspired cuisine. McQueen said that she struggled during COVID. At one point, she considered giving up the restaurant business. Then she received the James Beard nomination, and the opportunity to open a new concept in Snowmass was presented, and she realized that she couldn't quit now. I guess someone is telling me that I'm doing something okay, she says with a laugh. Note at the bottom, Mawita is located at 49 Wood Road in Snowmass Village, open from 12 noon to 9 p.m. daily. And Mawa's Kitchen is located 305 Aspen Airport Business Center in Aspen, open 8 to 10:30 a.m. Monday through Friday for breakfast. And then they have lunch from 11 to 3 and dinner from 5 to 9:30. Then on the weekends, Saturday and Sunday, they're open from 8 to 3. Next, turning to the New York Times from their fashion department. Finally, an inclusive range of gowns for brides of color. Quote, nude fabrics and undergarments are often beige or white. More bridal designers of color are trying to change that. This is written by Sadiba Hassan, posted March 7th. In January, Tessa Tooks tried on her dream wedding dress at a bridal boutique in Ontario. When the store employees told her she would have to pay $200 for the bra cups of the gown to match her skin color, her heart sank. The beige cups that had already been built into the dress, however, were free. Ivory cups were also a free option. Miss Tooks, who is black, loved the dress so much that she put down a deposit for half the price of the gown, but when she returned home, she had time to process what had happened. Quote, "When the dust settled a week later, I was like, I probably don't want to wear this dress anymore," Miss Tooks, 28, said. She went on, "It just feels kind of icky and wrong." When her fiancé Joey Kirshner, 34, learned about the incident, he expressed his outrage on their joint TikTok account. In a video that has received more than 4.5 million views and 12,000 comments, Mr. Kirshner, an actor and a model, said in the video, "So you're telling me that it's free to be white?" In an interview, Mr. Kirshner, who is white, added, quote, "Why is the standard nude a nude that would match my skin tone?" After the couple posted the video, a representative from the boutique messaged them and offered the brown cups for free, said Ms. Tooks, a model and people operations specialist. But she believed that the boutique did not take accountability for how the experience made her feel. A few hours later, as the video was receiving attention, the representative reached out again. This time, the boutique offered the entire dress for free. Ms. Tooks said, "I think they were getting nervous that we would expose their name." Parentheses, the couple did not accept the offer or name the boutique. Since then, many designers have reached out to the couple, advertising their inclusive policies. Last week, Miss Tooks visited a few stores in New York and even found her new wedding dress. Miss Tooks' experience at the boutique in Ontario is one shared by many women of color shopping for wedding dresses. For her wedding in May 2023, Ashley Oliver Thomas paid $150 for the bra cups of her ceremony gown to be dyed to match her skin color. She said, "It almost sounds like it's a black tax or a person of color tax." Ms. Thomas, 36, and a diversity director who lives in Lexington, Kentucky, added that the fabric of the dresses she had seen in the stores she went to matched lighter skin tones. She had to do a lot of visualizing to imagine what they would look like after the alterations were done. Ms. Thomas said, "The terms sheer and nude mean taupe or beige. I am a darker-skinned black woman. I'm more of a chestnut, chocolate." Ms. Thomas added that she felt like she was burdened to ask questions about whether designers offer the option to dye the lace or the mesh of a gown, and about the corresponding costs. Ms. Thomas said, "Having those conversations is extra labor for brides of color." "Usually the bridal market caters to white young girls," said Rachel Soho, a bridal stylist in Chicago. That's why she prefers to work with brands like Essay Azenbourg and boutiques like Belle Atelier, professionals who cater to brides of all ethnicities. That's also why Miss Thomas felt she needed to work with a black designer for her reception outfit, an illusion dress, a style made with a sheer tulle base that is meant to blend in with the bride's skin. She went with Brides by Nona, an atelier in Marietta, Georgia, that offers different shades at no additional charges. Ms. Thomas said that was a big relief. Gbemi Okunlola, the founder of the fashion brand Olonuko, is particularly known for her illusion gowns. After shopping with her sister for her wedding in 2014, Ms. Okunlola started her own bridal collection and designed a sheer tulle for black women. She said, "Every part of the dress that would work for a white bride, we made it so that it would work for us. That includes zippers, hanging loops, and threads on the dress, and 25 color options, She said, "It's not a simple process, but one that is a priority for her." Ms. Okunlola said, "It does cost a lot more to provide this many options, but it's almost like brands are penalizing people for being a different skin color to what the default is." After posting on TikTok, Ms. Tooks said she had noticed some changes. She saw that the website of the designer that had charged for the cups updated its language from, quote, "brown cups available separately" to, quote, "all cups available." Ms. Tooks said, "A small change, but one that definitely has an impact." Still reading from the New York Times, a fire department chaplain breaking barriers. The Reverend Pamela Holmes will be sworn in today as the fire department's second female chaplain and the first Black woman in the role. And that today was March 7th. It was posted by James Barron. To visit a firehouse in Brooklyn recently, the Reverend Pamela Holmes wore a shirt with a fire department emblem and her clerical collar. Quote, "You want to wear something identifiable so that people will know who you are, will know you are who you say you are," said Holmes, who will be sworn in today as the fire department's second female chaplain. She will be the first Black woman in the role in a department that long resisted efforts to diversify its ranks. Holmes is one of seven chaplains, six of them Christian and one Jewish. Each is on tour or on duty one day a week. Holmes is also an associate pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church in the Clinton Hill section of Brooklyn. The chaplains provide counseling to firefighters and other fire department employees and can assist when families are notified about a firefighter who died in the line of duty. They make hospital visits to injured or sick firefighters. They also do invocations or prayers at ceremonies like street namings. But Holmes values days when there is time to visit firehouses. On one visit, she chatted with a female firefighter who said she is Muslim. Quote, "She was floored that I had read the Quran," said Holmes. As the conversation ended, the firefighter said, "Hey, chaplain, we don't have an imam right now. Until they get one, if I need one, can I call you?" Holmes said that the encounter illuminated her approach to the chaplain job. Quote, "This is about building relationships, because then people will trust you enough to open up and share." She had been on the board of the EMS-FDNY Help Fund, a nonprofit that provides assistance to emergency medical technicians and paramedics. For several years, when she heard that the department was seeking a chaplain, she uploaded her resume, went for two interviews, and waited. She said, "Typical of the city, it was months and months. I thought, I guess they found somebody. They're not interested in me. I'll keep on with the fund and let God figure out the rest." Then she heard that she was a finalist and got the job, a part-time position that pays about $32,000 a year. In recent years, much of the attention paid to the fire department has centered on racial diversity. Black firefighters make up 10% of the department's workforce last year, compared with 7.5% in 2019. Hispanics accounted for 15.6% last year, which is up from 12.5% in 2019. And Asian firefighters were at 2.4% last year, which is up slightly from 2% in 2019. Holmes, 57, worked as a paralegal in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office after college, then earned a master's degree in a program for aspiring politicians, only to decide that running for office was not for her. She shifted to education, eventually working on programs to promote diversity and provide opportunities for African American and Latino students. By then, she said she was singing in the choir at Emmanuel Baptist. She said, "God was tugging, tugging, tugging. I would say no, and God would say yes, and I realized you couldn't say no to God." By 2012, she had delivered her trial sermon and left for the Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. She received a Master's of Divinity degree in 2014 and returned to Emmanuel Baptist. She said her first visit to a firehouse ended with a conversation with two firefighters. Quote, one of them was a jokester and said, I don't know about women preaching. Can you really preach? She replied, you're a firefighter. Can you really put out a fire? And the other firefighter told her, you were not what I expected. And then he said, Chaplain, promise me, if something happens to me, will you be the one who comes? Holmes said, I got in the car and I said, now I understand the assignment. Returning to a Colorado news source, the next one comes from CPR News. This was posted March 1st, written by Anthony Cotton. Aviation pioneer charts her own course from the basketball court to the cockpit. Growing up, Emlyss Ward considered any number of careers, including acting, and indeed bright lights awaited her. They just weren't coming from Hollywood. Ward, who lives in Denver, is the first black woman to become a captain at a U.S. passenger airline, United. And 3 decades later, she paves the way for future aviators as a flight instructor. Ward told Colorado Matter senior host Ryan Warner, quote, I'd like to leave a legacy by being a part of something that's bigger than myself. Maybe mentor someone or inspire someone to go out and do something bigger and better than I could have ever dreamed of. That might be hard to do because of the extraordinary life Ward has led. Even before she flew for United, Ward made history as the first black instructor pilot in the Air Force, at a time when women weren't allowed to fly those planes in combat. And even before that, Ward made her mark as a member of the University of Southern California women's basketball team, a squad that featured Hall of Fame players Cheryl Miller and Cynthia Cooper. Ward said athletics and the idea of competing had been essential to her accomplishments. She said, quote, when you play on a national championship team, you're not used to losing. So it made me incredibly competitive that I was not going to fail at anything I tried in life because I like being a champion. I like being a winner. And so that kind of always set the tone for anything I attempted in my life. End quote. Ward also talked about her experiences as a minority, as a black woman in male-dominated areas like the military and flying for the commercial airline, as a member of the LGBTQ+ community, and her concerns that previous gains made in inclusivity could be lost. She said, I am alarmed at the precedents of this country to remove precedents. We are re-adjudicating decisions made, important decisions made in the history of our country, and saying we know better than what someone before us did. And I do see us moving in an alarmingly wrong direction. End quote. The following is from the interview that aired, edited. Emlyss Ward, first the question. You were the Air Force's first black instructor pilot. Your aviation career began after a chance encounter at the University of Southern California, where you played basketball. How do athletics prepare you for a cockpit? The preparation for flying is not very dissimilar to the preparation for a game, so you learn plays, you learn the opponent, how you're going to guard them and hopefully defend them to beat them. And so the approach was quite the same. I prepared by studying and being ready for all the tests, and there were numerous of those. And then there's this thing called chair flying, where you kind of mentally picture the flight before you actually go do that. And that was very similar to what I experienced, not just in basketball, but all the sports. But I will tell you, what prepared me from an athletic standpoint was when you play on a national championship team, you're not used to losing. The interviewer. The chair flying makes a lot of sense to me. The idea that you run through the flights or the game or whatever the task is ahead of you in your mind, that makes you better prepared. Do you still do that? Ward, absolutely. Even today when I'm preparing to go either fly myself or participate in training in the simulator, and I'm really just playing the role of captain or first officer for a student. I always study and make sure that I know exactly what controls I should be touching at what time and in what order, and the checklist that I either have to read or respond to. You never stop studying as a pilot. You never rely on, oh yeah, I've been there, done that, I know what I'm doing. Because the book always changes anyway, you don't just go through it in your mind. Actually, your hands are moving during chair flying, where you would normally be touching controls. Next question. It's interesting you can say you can't hide being, that you do say, pardon me, you can't hide being a woman or being black. I'm just speaking from personal experience. It's not all that easy sometimes to hide that you're gay. I mean, people kind of read me all the time. They certainly read me as a kid, read me as a kid before I read myself. So it can take some effort to be in the closet. Ward answers, oh, absolutely. In fact, it's funny that you say that, because if you ask folks that I went to high school with, all of my classmates, they'll tell you that they knew I was gay, and I didn't know I was gay in high school. I'm like, why didn't you tell me? You would have saved me a lot of heartache and trouble instead of trying to figure this out all myself in college. But you're absolutely right, and obviously there are characteristics that people will automatically attribute to you that say, oh, you must be gay because you're assertive, or you're not afraid to speak up, and you walk tall. And I'm like, there's a lot of straight women that do that too. That's just your preconceived notions. But I never really tried to hide my personality. I just didn't fully disclose the rest of the story. Next question. You flew fighter jets in the Air Force at breakneck speeds, but you've said cracking the sound barrier, so more than 750 miles an hour is kind of ho-hum. Ward says, well, first of all, I didn't fly fighter jets. The training jets, one of them, the T-38, did break the sound barrier. Unfortunately, at that time in the Air Force, and really in all of the military, women weren't allowed to fly in combat, so I actually never had the opportunity to fly a fighter jet. But I instructed our initial trainer, which was still aerobatic, and I trained a lot of other guys to go fly their fighters, but I never got the opportunity. I had an offer at one point in time, in about 1993, to actually go fly when women were allowed to fly in combat. I was offered a position to go fly an A-10, but eventually I just turned it down because it just wasn't in the cards for me at that time in my life to go fly in a unit in Pennsylvania when I lived in Chicago. Question. So, there are a few things I'd like to follow up on. How is breaking the sound barrier ho-hum? Ward. You know why? Because it's more dramatic for the people on the ground. Nothing happens in the airplane. There's no boom when you're flying it, and the speed dial and the airspeed indicator does a little bit of a flick, and your instructor says, oh yeah, you just cracked a sound barrier. I'm like, oh yeah, that was exciting. I was like, can we do the loop again? I mean, that's more exciting to do the aerobatic stuff instead of going fast. I've broken the sound barrier twice. One was intentionally when we all had one ride where we got to do it. And then one was unintentional. It was in a formation flight. I was the second aircraft in a two-man ship, and I was complaining to my instructor, quote, God, I am all over the place. I can't seem to stay in the position where I should be. And he's like, that's because we're going faster than the speed of sound, and we're not supposed to be. So you're actually doing a really good job for the speeds we're flying. So one was intentional, one was unintentional, and both were ho-hum. Next question. And then to this idea that you would train men, you would get them ready to fly fighters, but women were not allowed so much in those roles. What a crock of BS. Ward. Well, there's a lot of crock of BS for women as we progressed through the 80s and the 90s, and bit by bit we peeled back that onion and worked for our opportunities. I didn't take it that way, though. We all had a role. It's a teamwork thing. When you're in the military, you don't belabor the idea that, oh, somebody has an opportunity and I don't. You just do your job, and you do it really well because, in the end, we're all in the same team trying to protect our country for the freedoms, for everyone to have. So you don't think of it in that way. I didn't think it like I was being restricted. I just looked at it like, okay, what can I fly? Here's my list, and I chose. They were all great opportunities, and in the end, flying the cargo planes that I eventually flew in the military really prepared me for the commercial career that I had. Whereas the gentlemen that did fly fighters, they had a little bit rougher transition when they left the military to go fly commercial. It's a little bit different for them to have to learn how to brief a crew and work with flight attendants and people, which is something we did all the time in the military on the cargo planes. Do you remember your first flight as a passenger? I did fly as a kid. I don't remember it, but I've got to tell you this story. My mom remembers it quite well. I think I was maybe 3 and my sister was 4, and my sister and I were sitting next to each other, and my mom was in the row behind us sitting next to a man. I believe it was a configuration of just 2 and then middle seats and then 2. And it was both of our first flights, and I was super excited and my older sister was not. And as we rolled down the runway, my mom said that I yelled at the top of my lungs, "We're going to crash! We're going to die! We're going to crash! We're going to die!" And I'm just laughing and my sister's crying. And the man that was sitting next to my mother said, "The mother of that child must be so embarrassed." And she said, "I am." I was a little. And she said it was unbelievable how I was unfazed by flying. And here's my sister, terrified, next to me and terrorized even more by me. So she said, "I always wanted to fly planes. I talked about it when I was young. I don't remember it." And she might be making it up, but I don't think she is. Question: is she making up the stories that I've heard that you leaped off garage roofs in your neighborhood as a kid? That is not made up. I do remember that. I did a lot of things when I was growing up. I was ultra tomboy. So yeah, I did some fun things. I came home with cuts and bruises. One time she thought I'd put my eye out because I came home with a big towel over my head. It was bloody, and I had just run into a pole playing football with the boys and didn't even need stitches, but it bled a lot. So yeah, my mom doesn't make up any stories. She's very literal. She does not lie. She's a doctor. She took that oath very seriously, so that's true. I jumped off roofs. What do you like least about the job? That's kind of hard. Is there anything I don't like about my job? So the all-nighter flying is no fun. Luckily, I'm senior enough not to do that anymore unless I want to. But that is flying them some of the odd hours or the long, long days. That's tough. It's always tough. Yep. Whenever we get tired, it's tough to fly an airplane. On several occasions, you've mentioned landings. Are those the most difficult part of flying? It's the most difficult part to do extremely well. It's not that hard to land an aircraft unless you have some other conditions that make it tough, like hot days, crosswinds, low weather, nighttime, short runways, or wet runways. But to do it well, and actually, this is one of the things that I tell the pilots that come through United every time in the simulator, I go, "You can land safely and clunk it on, or you could actually take pride in what kind of landing you do. So actually work hard at it. Don't just say, 'Oh, that's good enough.' Never be satisfied. Nothing like landing the airplane and no one knows you touched down. That is really a great feeling." Yep. And what still needs to change in commercial aviation to make it a more diverse, more welcoming, frankly? It's absolutely down to exposure. Women and women of color, they just need to have the opportunity, and the opportunities are scarce because of either exposure or because of financial obligations. And so that's one of the things I'm incredibly proud of with United Airlines, creating the Aviate Academy, because they've given pathways for people to be in this career field that before would have immediately dismissed it because they didn't have the money or the opportunity to do so. Last question about a role model. Was your mom your role model? She definitely was one of two, and she's absolutely my role model. It's not because she was the first or one of the first black women to graduate from the University of Chicago, but because she did it in her 30s. And I mean, to go back to medical school when you have three kids and you're still feeding them and washing clothes and being a traditional mom, and then to excel at that, it basically told me that you can do anything you want in life, and if you wake up one day and you're not doing what you want to do, change it. When you have someone that's that overachieving in your life, everything seems possible. And it was. I honestly credit everything to my mom, and just what an amazing role model she was for me. Next, returning to the New York Times for an opinion guest essay, which was posted March 3rd, Easing the Daily Reality of My Strangeness. This was written by Esau Macaulay. Like many African American professors, I teach at a predominantly white institution, Wheaton College, and live in the largely white small city where it's located, outside Chicago. I have not experienced serious acts of discrimination, but that doesn't make life simple. When people think about the difficulty of being black in largely white spaces in America, they tend to picture overt racism. But many of us who are in the minority at universities encounter a different kind of problem related to our race that may go unnoticed by those in the majority culture. At Wheaton, I'm faced with the daily reality of my strangeness, like being a peacock in a flock of wild turkeys. The peacock is interesting and adds some color, but the fact that it is not native to the area is clear to all. While diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts have their flaws in content and implementation, one of their unsung values is that they can help reduce this kind of strain on black faculty members and students on majority white campuses. More diversity can help ease our sense of not belonging. Despite the ongoing hysteria around diversity and hiring in higher education, black faculty members are shockingly uncommon. Only 6% of professors in this country in 2021. We face obstacles inside and outside the classroom. Black faculty members at largely white schools can be subjects of scrutiny based on assumptions that our race, rather than our talent, won us our positions. At academic conferences, I have been told directly that I got my job because I was black. On campus, I walk into the classroom knowing that for many of my white students, I may be the first black authority figure they have encountered. Their church leaders, high school teachers, and mayors are likely to have been white. Because of this, I rarely have the luxury of being myself. Black faculty members in my position become Black People Consolidated, correcting misconceptions and putting away stereotypes one class at a time. When traumatic racial events flash across the national landscape, students of color look to us, hoping that we might address a gnawing pain that is ignored in their other classes. All of this is part of the well-known and still underappreciated invisible labor that faculty members of color provide. Beyond work, tasks that seem simple for the majority culture become quests that involve connecting to an underground network of other black veterans in the community. Want a haircut for your son or braids for your daughter? It may be necessary to leave town to find the right barber shop or salon. In need of a place of worship that is not monocultural and cut off from the concerns of the community that shaped you, you may have to journey to the closest major city to locate such a congregation. If nothing for you is near you, it is easy to conclude that your town was and is designed for someone else. I have always valued having ethnic diversity among my friends. That can be hard to find when I am the diversity. My kids, for example, are guaranteed to pop up on nearly every candid shot on social media from school, sports, or neighborhood events. My wife and I want to recruit people to those spaces so that our kids can have a multi-ethnic friend group. But we are wary of the risks of becoming mascots. I remember taking my youngest daughter to her soccer game at a vast town park filled with a multitude of tiny bodies with dreams of World Cup glory. During a break in the action, I looked across the 8 or so matches taking place. Parents filled the sidelines, but as far as I could tell, I was the only black person in attendance. I suddenly felt unspeakably lonely as I remembered similar experiences at all of my kids' school events and trips around the city. When I felt out of place as a black undergrad on the largely white campus of Sewanee, the University of the South, I could go to Houston Robertson's office. He was the first African-American person to earn tenure at that school. Robertson's specialty was race, religion, and the black church, with an emphasis on the civil rights movement. I had always been enthralled by the black church's role in the civil rights movement, which made his presence on campus feel like a minor miracle. He made black excellence in white spaces real, showing me that I could gain an education and not lose something vital about who I was in the process. If I had told him of my plan to become a professor, would he have warned me that I was entering a building not designed for me and that I would be considered ungrateful for pointing out the flaws in the architecture? The efforts of DEI programs on campus can help with these necessary renovations. Being intentional about increasing the numbers of minorities on campus does not get in the way of academic excellence. It can help rid students and faculty members of obstacles that get in the way of our flourishing. A 2021 study showed that, quote, having a professor of the same race or ethnicity predicted higher GPAs for students, which in turn predicted higher graduation rates. This does not surprise me. It wasn't simply that I did well in Dr. Robeson's courses. The content of his class showed me that my intellect could be deployed to benefit oppressed people. He helped me give purpose to the effort involved in obtaining a degree. This is why I stay. Colleges and universities are places where young people are finding themselves socially, intellectually, and morally. I know in particular how hard it can be for black students to go through that process in circumstances that are unfamiliar and disorienting. I want to believe that there is room enough and charity enough for everyone on campus to thrive together. A note at the bottom. Esau McCauley, his name is spelled E-S-A-U, is a contributing opinion writer, the author of How Far to the Promised Land, One Black Family's Story of Hope and Survival in the American South. And he is an associate professor of New Testament at Wheaton College. The Times is committed to publishing a diversity of letters to the editor. We'd like to hear what you think about this or any of our articles. And here's our email, letters@nytimes.com. And that brings me to just about the end of our time for this week, so we'll close a minute early. Thank you so much for joining us for the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.